This week on Vox Talks, will the UK and Europe be able to strike a deal on financial services? And what happens if they don't? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. And welcome to a special Vox Talk from the SWEF DNB conference at the Dutch Central Bank in Amsterdam, titled Forging a New Future Between the UK and the EU. SWEF was founded in 1963 by a group of academics and bankers to focus on financial markets, institutions and regulation. So, of course, high on the agenda for this conference, what sort of deal can the UK do with Europe on financial services? And what would be the consequences for either side of the dreaded no deal?
Nations do not just have divergent or competing interests, but also enduring common interests.
In his opening address, Klaas Knot, president of DNB, is a member of the ECB's governing council too. He's emphasizing the common interests of the two sides in a negotiation. But I know of at least one of the delegates who's going to be speaking here today who thinks that maybe the common interests aren't great enough to make a deal. David Miles of Imperial College is a CEPR fellow and a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. In his speech, he's going to be focusing on what he thinks might be irreconcilable conflict in the views of the two sides and the UK's desire to, well, you all know the phrase by now, take back control of financial services regulation in the City of London. This is partly motivated by the sheer size of the city, he explains.
It's big. It dominates many international markets. It's vastly larger in terms of the scale of financial services than any other financial centre in Europe. Around about 75% of all EU foreign exchange transactions go through London. The same would be true, that kind of proportion, for many derivative transactions, interest rate derivatives in particular. Before the referendum a few years ago, slightly more than 50% of all equity issued by companies in the EU was issued through London. So it really is, by a very long way, the dominant financial centre in Europe. It's kind of up there with the dominant financial centres in the world. On some metrics, it's number one in the world, and some it's number two, but it's absolutely dominant in Europe.
And we heard already this morning, and Remainers in the UK have been worrying about this for a long time, that these functions are going to migrate over to the euro area after Brexit, Dublin, Frankfurt, Paris. How long is that going to take to do if it happens?
Well, I think it depends on how the negotiations play out over the course of this year, 2020. And if you're optimistic about this, it may be that an agreement will be reached. Clearly, the UK will be outside the single market. There won't be so-called passporting of financial services. Nonetheless, if there was a sort of wide-ranging agreement on so-called equivalence, that would allow firms based in the UK to have access to many financial markets. And if you're optimistic about all this, we could end up in a situation where most of the things that happen in London in terms of providing financial services to the EU can stay in London. Whether or not that's the most likely outcome, I'm somewhat dubious about, but it's a possible outcome. And therefore, I suspect that not many financial institutions in London will be moving lots of people this year. They'll at least wait to see how things play out. It may not be obvious even by the end of this year and into next year quite what any agreement on equivalence actually means in practice. So my guess is this will not be a rush to the exits in London. It'll be a relatively slow moving thing. Of course, over the course of 5-10 years, it could be very substantial.
Some have moved already, though, haven't they, David? As Klaas was saying, even payment services moving here to Amsterdam and Dublin, Frankfurt.
It's true. Some things have moved already. Financial institutions have moved some people. My impression overall is that the scale of that so far is not enormous, just in terms of the number of people who work in the City of London, 300,000-400,000 people maybe. I think one's talking about thousands of people having moved, probably not even many tens of thousands. So far, relatively small.
Beginning of 2020, the priority this year is to get an agreement on services, financial services. What does the UK want from that agreement?
I think what the UK wants is an agreement that, as long as the rules, the regulations, the system of supervision of financial institutions in London is broadly equivalent in the sense that the aims of the regulation and the outcomes that come from it are consistent with the outcomes and the aims of EU regulation, that should be enough to allow UK firms to offer services out of London to the EU and the other way around. So that's a kind of what you might call a flexible interpretation of what regulatory equivalence means. I think on the other side, from the European Commission side, it's a bit less clear. It may be, and there are some indications that it might well be, that equivalence will be interpreted in a much stricter way. In other words, UK regulations, supervision, rules will be deemed to be equivalent if they are literally almost exactly the same as the EU regulations. Now, that would mean, of course, that if that's how the EU interprets equivalence, and you need equivalence in order to have access to the European markets from London, then that's going to be a very difficult place for the UK, because the UK will not want, as one of the largest financial centres in the world, to be taking rules on financial regulation about which it will have no say, that it literally has to follow almost to the letter. That's not going to fly. So quite where we get to from those two positions is a bit unclear. And it's interesting to look at the political declaration of the withdrawal agreement has all of two paragraphs on financial services. And they make some nice warm noises. And they say that we'll both be very considerate and consider each other's position. And we're all interested in nice outcomes and being friendly with each other. But actually, it doesn't tell you quite what either side means in terms of what do you really mean by equivalence.
While we've been sitting in the conference, even this morning, the Prime Minister spokespeople are briefing journalists to say that in the forthcoming negotiations, regulatory alignment is not the priority and it's not what they're looking for. So it's shot across the bows, isn't it?
Yes. So what they're saying is, if by alignment one means that the UK simply has to accept whatever the EU rules are and implement them, we ain't going to do that.
There's new management at the Commission. Are they going to be different to the old management?
Hard to say. I mean, there's a few straws in the wind, which, if, as I am, you're in favour of some sort of flexibility on the interpretation of equivalence in the area of financial services, these straws in the wind are not terribly promising. I mean, there was a statement, I think it was just before Christmas, by one of the European senior officials on the side of data access, which is actually kind of important for financial services. But basically, he said, look, the UK is going to be outside the EU come the end of January. It's going to have to join in the queue to be considered as to whether that we should continue to have free flows of data, crucial to financial services, of some significance to security issues as well.
Absolutely.
So saying that the UK has to join the queue, which has got 13 people in the queue already, is kind of saying, well, we've got rules and there are the rules. There's no flexibility about this. You're outside, you've made a decision, there you are. It doesn't sound to me like there's any kind of, oh, well, okay, now the reality is the UK is outside, now let's be a bit more flexible on what it all means, because it might be in our joint interest to show some flexibility. There's no indication of that so far.
We've already heard this morning the quote about how countries don't have friends, they only have interest. The interest, really, though, in the European Union is they've spent a decade trying to de-risk the Eurozone. They're worried if we have this bonfire of red tape, like UK politicians like to promise, that they're going to be inviting risk back in again if the UK is allowed to deviate from the sorts of regulatory standards they put in place.
Yes. I mean, I can understand in principle the fear that the UK, as you say, has a bonfire of regulations and activity moves to London, which is not regulated very stringently. I have to say, although I understand in principle the fear, I think in practice history provides no justification for taking that worry very seriously. In fact, the UK, certainly in the area of banking regulation, I think has erred on the stringent side relative to what's on average the case across the EU, certainly in terms of bank capital, for example. In fact, the UK, when some years ago now, the kind of new rules of the game on minimum amounts of capital for banks were introduced, the UK wanted the flexibility to impose more stringent requirements than the sort of lowest acceptable levels. And slightly bizarrely, and against the UK's interests, the legislation, as it was passed in a European directive, meant that you weren't allowed to go beyond the stringent level. So the ways in which in the past the UK has had problems with EU regulations have quite often been we want to be more stringent.
There's not a story you often hear told.
It isn't a story you often hear told. Of course, one story you do hear told is, the UK didn't want to have caps on bankers' bonuses. And that suggests that maybe they're more sympathetic toward the interests of big financial sector.
Or fat cats, yeah.
Fat cats and all that. And I think that's a pretty profound misreading of what the UK position was. The UK position, which I have some sympathy with, I have to say, is that to put caps on bankers' bonuses would simply mean that their basic salaries went up. That made those institutions more vulnerable because their costs were inflexible. It made them more vulnerable, more likely to get into problems than if you didn't have those caps. So the UK position on bonuses was absolutely not about, well, we must entice more bankers to come to London and make the regime more favourable for them. It wasn't that at all.
Fast forward to 12 months' time, we haven't done a deal on financial services. Who's the big loser?
Well, I think everybody loses, actually, if that happens. You know, there's some activities that are now predominantly taking place in London that will go to other European centres. I don't think they'll all go to the same place. There isn't a single other centre in the European Union where there'll be sort of big gains. I think stuff will get spread out a little bit. There's a reason why, over time, activity is concentrated in London, because there are some economic advantages to London, language, the legal system. So whatever activity moves from London will probably be done a little bit less effectively, a little bit more costly wherever it goes to. That's going to be a cost to the users of financial services throughout Europe. The UK will lose some highly paid jobs, which generate a bit of tax revenue for the UK government. So I think it's one of those lose-lose situations. Nobody gains from this. There may be some governments in Europe that fancy having a bigger financial sector, but I think they would be well advised to think about the position of the users of financial services rather than just having a few bigger flashy buildings in the centre of their cities and a little bit more tax revenue coming in from banking and other financial services companies.
Sounds like you think that there's a good chance that we won't get to a deal.
Well, I think it's a question about what does a deal really look like. I suspect there'll be a sort of slightly murky area about what equivalence actually means. The UK will push for equivalence means we're kind of aiming for the same things, and our set of rules in the UK have the effect of probably getting you there, although they're a bit different from the EU rules. The EU Commission, which has been pretty rigid so far, might say, no, equivalence means you really are equivalent. You've got to align with the EU rules. There may be some grey and murky areas around the edges that will allow some financial services to continue to be provided from London to the EU, but it won't be true everywhere. I think it will end up with a bit of lose-lose. But is this an economic disaster either for the UK or the EU? No, absolutely not. It's just something you could have been avoided and nobody's going to win it from it.
David's presentation has just finished, so I'm going to grab Ian Begg of the Dahrendorf Institute at the London School of Economics and ask him whether he agrees with David's analysis that no deal in financial services would damage the UK economy, but it wouldn't be the end of the world for either side.
The UK probably has more to lose than the European side, and that is going to colour the negotiations, because already we've seen some drift of financial services activity to other countries. It's a trickle. I don't think that trickle is going to become much greater, but it's all been one way. There is not financial services moving into the UK. And the three risks from this are, first, that you lose jobs. Second, that you lose net exports. And third, that you lose tax revenue. All of these three can be anticipated if what David has been talking about comes to pass, and if what we're already observing continues. I think David is maybe underestimating the dangers of this by saying it's only half a percentage point of GDP, because he's not taking account of the fact that that is likely to be an annual loss and will accumulate in the same way as his 20% since the crisis. But also there may be multiplier effects, because the people in the city are going to be displaced are high rollers. They spend a lot of money in the economy. I fear that he's maybe underplaying the risks to the UK economy collectively from the risks to financial services.
Thanks to David and Ian, and of course Vox EU will be carrying much more analysis of this topic during 2020. Next week, Vox Talks will come from the SWEF conference again, where a panel has been discussing regional inequality and its impact on global politics. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. There are new episodes every week, and remember, you can catch up with 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.